This podcast is sponsored by El Spilio. Happy New Year from the Caving Podcast and El Spilio, makers of some of the greatest lights you could ever put on that helmet of yours. And of course, if you are interested in investing in an El Spilio, investing in your caving life, you can go to elspilio.com. I've got a link in the description of this podcast and pick up a Lunatic. It's their top of the line light. And if you are interested in trying it out before you buy it, I might be able to hook you up. Lane Roberts, who I gifted the Lunatic to. Well, I let her borrow it. I didn't gift it to her. I wish I could have, Lane. I really wish I could have. And I appreciate your correspondence. Lane was so great. She works for Caverns of Sonora in Texas, and she's a relatively new caver, but she's gotten her feet pretty wet or dry, as it were, out there. And she's done an awful lot, but she borrowed my Lunatic for a few months and got it dirty in the high quads and down there in Texas, and has had a great time. And I really appreciate the updates from Lane. But I've got it back. It's back in my garage and it's ready to go to you. And I'm going to keep this thing going. If you would like to borrow my El Spilio Lunatic and try it out and see just how great it is, well, then email me, alpineproductions@gmail.com. And I'm in the NSS directory, alpineproductions@gmail.com. Let me know why you'd like it, where you'll take it, where you like to go, your caving experience, all that. And let's get an El Spilio Lunatic into the hands of someone who will get it dirty. And I cannot. That's why I'm doing this. Because this thing deserves to see some great places, places that I can't take it to. So alpineproductions@gmail.com is the email address. Elspilio.com if you want to buy your own. And hey, if you do, make sure to enter the promo code podcast to save $20 off that Elspilio Lunatic. Elspilio.com, promo code podcast. This is the Caving Podcast. Welcome to it. I'm Matt Pelser, your host. This is a podcast about caving, which is entering a cave and moving about, which requires some technical experience, some physical fitness, some mental fitness as well. And if you're here for the first time, welcome. If you've been here before, welcome back. And if you have never caved before, we encourage you to do it. We also encourage you to do it the right way and get involved with your local grotto. A grotto is like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, our national organization. And the reason we are organized and believe in that is because caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. It is quite the opposite if you do. And so we encourage you to go, the first few times you go, go with people who know what they're doing, and then you'll be one of those people who knows what they're doing, and then you can lead your own trips. But we also encourage organized caving just for the sake of keeping in touch with everybody and finding out where the frontiers are, knowing where the good places are. If we do this right, we can help each other out and lift up the entire sport. So find your local grotto and get involved. Happy New Year. Just like last year, I'm doing something special with the New Year's episode. Last year, I had Bill Steele, who, as we'll find out, there's a new term that I learned for someone like Bill Steele, a BNC, a big name caver. We talk about the whole big name caver thing here. If you've listened to this, you might notice that the name on the episode is my name. So this is an interview that Hazel Barton did with me. I didn't know she was going to do this. I didn't know she was going to spring an hour on me, but she came to Indiana Cave Capers and was our speaker. And before her presentation, she said, you know what, come by my campsite, bring your recording gear and let's chat. So I thought I was just going to get a little 10-15 minute update from Hazel. No. She wanted to know about me, which I wasn't comfortable with because I don't really think of myself as that significant of a caver, but she had other ideas and she has another perspective. She said, You do this. You do this podcast. And this has reached out to so many people. And so, all right, Hazel, I'll give you that. And I appreciate that very much. And Hazel, I appreciated the time that we spent. And I hope that you, as the listener, will as well. So hang tight for that. Real quick, before we get into it, another hobby of mine is microphone restoration. And if you follow me on Instagram, there are a few caver friends who follow me on Instagram. So I'm a radio personality in Indianapolis. That's my day job. I'm also a voiceover actor, and I really just love microphones. In fact, I talked to Hazel about it in this interview, just a little bit. And my favorite microphone, if I could pick a favorite, is the classic Shure 55 Unidyne, the Elvis mic. It's that chrome with the grill, you know? And it's what I'm recording this intro with right now. This is a classic Shure 55 Unidyne that I picked up from a guy in Alabama. What up, Tag Cavers? Usually can't find these things for less than $200, but I picked this one up for $60. It was in terrible shape. It did not work. I opened it up, fixed it, put some new foam in it, red foam. It's a red microphone. Yeah. And, well, you can hear it. It sounds pretty decent. And I put up a couple of photos of it on Instagram. It would really help me out. I guess this is what I'm trying to get at. It would really help me out if I could get a few more Instagram followers. And this isn't me, like, saying, follow me on Instagram. It's, as a radio personality, the more Instagram followers I have, it's so stupid. It's like this brand value thing. So if you're a caver and you've got Instagram and you want to help out a fellow caver, give me a like. I've got a link to my Instagram account in the description of this podcast. All right. I feel like such a shill saying something like that, but anyway. So yeah, Hazel and I get into it. She was curious about my personal caving life and my philosophy on caving and the podcast. And we just had a great time. If you heard the Cave Capers episode from this past September, you may remember that I actually got to go caving with Hazel the very next day. The day after we recorded this, we went to Gory Hole, which we talk a little bit about in the podcast, which is Indiana's deepest pit at about 140 feet. She schooled me on vertical. I leaned back on the rope without holding it and without doing a quick tie off. Stupid move. Nothing happened, but still, it was a dumb move. And Hazel called me out for it, and I appreciated that. Because that's, you need to do that when you're doing vertical. Somebody screws up, and you say, hey, you screwed up there. That's not proper technique. And talk about somebody who has been not everywhere and hasn't done everything, but in comparison to a lot of us, she's come pretty close. So it was an honor to be interviewed. First of all, it was an honor to interview Hazel back a few years ago. And then to be interviewed by her was just an unbelievable highlight in my caving life. And my life as a person who appreciates science and all that she has done for the world of science and cave exploration for that matter. So here is an hour at Hazel Barton's campsite at Indiana Cave Capers 2021, talking caving.
Is this okay with the drone in the background? Is that not going to be an issue?
Oh, I don't care.
It's not
for you. It's ambiance.
Oh, is that right?
It's ambiance. It sets the scene. We hear the bugs all around.
Oh, that's true.
Every once in a while. I hope it happens during our conversation. We'll hear a cicada somewhere.
So are you going to let everybody know that we're sitting in the middle of a field in Indiana? It's 90 degrees.
Well, at least you brought a canopy, because
yes.
I did not. I'm
yes.
sitting in the sun.
Oh.
To get a sunburn on a caving weekend is kind of a badge of shame, don't you think?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
it
should
either
be
means
in before dawn and out after dark.
Yeah, you should either be underground during the sunny part or at the very least be smart enough to bring the right gear. I am neither, so.
I have like my cave camping set up for convention, and so I just like have it together. So I have like my thing. I got a table, I got a stove and everything. It's pretty standard.
You're all set. Well, I mean, you're used to worse conditions.
I like this though, car camping.
Yeah, this is nice though. This is nice.
Yeah.
So
I went caving today.
You went to Geistover Pit, which is a gnarly entrance to the Binkley system.
I went to Binkley.
Yeah. How far did you go though?
We went
You were with Rand, who's leading the project.
Yeah, right? He's really interesting. He's got a lot of really cool information about the cave. Told us about getting flooded in, and that was a really interesting story.
Yeah, about coming up on five years
is
ago.
It that? Yeah, it sounded like it was a big rescue, and I guess one of the landowners like knew that they were going in and knew that it looked like it was bad rain and knew there was going to be a problem. So the rescue started before they even realized in the cave that they were going to need rescue.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So,
but it was a surprise rain event. Like, it wasn't on the forecast.
No, it was like 10% rain.
They knew better.
Yeah. They knew better, and it was 10% rain. But it's not my story to tell. So I think, one of the things we discussed on this tour today,
yeah,
is that we feel that the podcast is really missing something.
Oh, okay.
And we really feel that no one has asked you your story. And
no,
so, and I know
that's why we haven't talked about it.
I know.
It's boring.
It's not boring. I think, what you've done has been really transformative, and it kind of bothers me a little bit whenever you're dismissive when you say I'm not that kind of caver, because I don't think that there's at least
here's the thing, I don't even think that I have done enough to even say what kind of caver I am. Does that make sense?
But do you have to, does there have to be an adjective in front of what caver you are?
I guess you're right, there doesn't.
There's not there's not a yardstick, there's not a measure, there's not a line that or boundary that you have to cross to be...
If you go caving, you're a caver.
Right. And and I think that's really important for people to remember, is it doesn't really matter if you go once a year or you go 60 times a year, if you have that interest and you have that passion. So I guess my question to you is, do you have that passion?
Well, I'm here. So, yeah.
So that makes you a caver. So does that qualify us to ask you your story?
Well, sure. All right. But, okay. What part do you want to know, I guess?
So I guess what you've done is very different. And I think you've been very successful. And I think the other thing that we've seen that's been similarly successful is what Derek Bristol did with his videos, mm-hmm. where he just did it because it was a passion project to him to create these things. And he didn't really do it to make himself noticed or give notoriety or become like a better known caver, because he was all those things to begin with. He just did it because he enjoyed it, and it's been transformative. And you've done the same thing with this podcast. And I have to say, I'll be out and about, and, you know, I'll go caving with people that I, you know, I don't really know, but they feel that they know me because they've listened to the podcast. and you laugh, but it's great because I can ask them about them, right? There's no need for me to be the center of attention. I can ask them about them. And also, you know, there's a lot of new people that come into caving. So do you get people like that send you emails and say, this got me excited about caving, this made me cross the barrier? So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I've heard from a few people, and not even directly from those people. I've heard from other people that say, you know, these people who I cave with got into it because of the podcast, because I told them about the podcast and they wanted to see what it was about. And that's there's no better reason to do it for me, honestly, is to get other people interested in it. You know what I mean? And also to share these oral histories of people. You know, I mean, I talked to Dick Blenz a year before he died, and we spent 3 hours together, and that was so special. And there are a few other people who are getting on in years that I've talked to. Another person that's passed away, Dale Chase from Canada. And so these people who are full of stories, and Dale knows how to tell them well, and so did Dick, who need to have their stories heard by the rest of the caving community, because they're the people who have inspired so many other people through their stories and their experiences to do it as well. I mean, Dick ran the Spelio spot in Indiana, you know? That needs to be shared. And it does take someone who knows how to edit it and make everybody's story listenable. but everybody's got one, and some edits are harder than others. But as far as like what I've done and that, I don't know. What I'm always trying to get from people is, what is the feeling that you get that keeps you caving, and where do you get that feeling? Where do you find the dragon that you're then chasing all the other times that you're not caving? You know what I mean? And for me, being in Indiana, that is in a bathtub, you know, or in a water crawl. And a perfect example is Buddha Cave in Indiana, where you're water crawling, you're going through what for the better part of the year is a sump, and you're also surrounded by formations. So you're soaking wet, you're cold, you're in a tight space, you're surrounded by beauty, but it's still really, really challenging. And that's the dragon that I'm always chasing. You know,
what is it? What is it about that situation that you find so appealing?
It's the challenge and the adventure, physically and mentally. You know, it's the fact that I know so many people who wouldn't ever, ever, ever do that.
Right.
You know, and I can. And part of me sometimes, when I'm thinking about that, thinks, am I just doing it to feel like a badass? But I'm not one of those kinds of people who wants to feel like a badass. It's just like, this is a super adventurous thing that I do, and not everybody can do it. And I think that's pretty cool. And I want to talk to other people whose brain works kind of the same way, you know, and get their experience, find out what dragon they're chasing.
And what did you find? Is it similar for everybody, or is it widely different?
Well, for some people, it's virgin passage. It's not that way for me. But maybe that's because I haven't been caving enough to get bored with just the adventure of caving itself. And I've never really been in Virgin Passage. I've been in places where only about, where less than a dozen people have ever been. It's like I can say more people have been on the moon than have been here, but I maybe haven't done it enough to have that kind of excitement about it. To me, just going caving is enough for now.
So let's backtrack a little bit.
All right.
Because I know you were the chair of the Central Indiana Grotto.
Mm-hmm.
So can you take me from that history of, like, what's a cave to becoming the chair of the grotto?
Okay. Well, I think I can thank the podcast for that appointment, because I started doing the podcast, and then the chair at that time, Joe Kinder, who I've interviewed on the podcast, and I think probably it was because I interviewed him that he decided to then nominate me for chair. He was like, well, here's somebody who's doing something, and why don't we, you know, offer him a leadership position? Because you know how hard it is to find people who will do that. And so I did it, and I loved it. It's a lot of work. I can't do it now that I've got two small kids. I only had one at that time. But what got me to there is, so I started caving in 2010 and caved for a while off and on. And then I did the podcast because I wanted something to do, some kind of project, and it's turned out really nice. But I didn't think I'd be doing it 5 years on. And then Joe was like, well, he does this podcast. So I did it. It went well. And now, like, I'm glad to have done it. And I'll do it again someday, maybe years down the road. But now I can say what it's like to be in leadership and say to people that it's not that hard. And if you want things to be different in your grotto, you can just go do it. And I didn't really want anything to be different in my grotto. I liked the way we operated and still do. So I just kind of kept things the same. But I've heard from other people that have had issues with their grotto. And it's like, just they probably are, they're tired. Just go do it. You go do it, which is great.
I think you've asked a lot of people that you've interviewed similarly about that. And I think that's often the missing piece, is you just have to be willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just putting that time aside. So if we go back, how did you start caving and how did you find the grotto? Were they kind of the same event?
No, kind of. So I started caving with a guy named Paul Uglum, who I've interviewed on the podcast. It was supposed to be me and him and one or two other people going into Sullivan Cave. And before that, I'd been to show caves and whatnot. But we went to Sullivan Cave in Indiana. And on the morning when we were supposed to go, it was just him and me. So it was just the two of us, which is like a no-no, you know, especially for first-timers. But he knew the cave so well, and it's a harmless cave. So it was just me and him. We went through. He took me up and down and all around and to the mountain room and a few other places and back out. And I was just like, how often can you do this? Like, when can we do this again? And I don't know if he knew that I was as into it as I was at the time. But when I found out that he was taking another group a few weeks later, I remembered to bring, because he and I went to the same church together. I no longer do that. But I knew that he was going. And so I brought my helmet with me, and I was like, can I come along? I was like a little schoolboy. Can I come along, tag along? So I became like a de facto, like, second leader on that trip. And then we went on a few other trips, and that was it. And then I started caving without him, though not much, and found kind of a core group. We would go and do stuff. We knew what our limitations were and our strengths as well, and there were a lot of strengths, so we'd go do harder and harder stuff just for fun. You know, we didn't do survey or anything, and that was enough for me.
So when you kind of did that, as you know, the evolution from just kind of an interest in being led around, how did that evolution look? Did you talk to landowners or talk to other cavers, find the cave, get a map, or were you more interested in kind of going in and poking around and finding your way around?
We really just went to the Indiana Karst Conservancy properties, and then of course Buckner, which was easy to get into through the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy. You know, occasionally we'd hear about another trip in a private cave through someone else who knew the landowner and all that. And so then you get to know those people. But there's not a whole lot of that. There wasn't a whole lot of that. It was mostly IKC properties, which to me, they're the big caves. You got Sullivan, which is like almost 10 miles long. You've got Wayne, which is 4.5. You've got Buckner through the RBNC, which is a 3.5 mile cave. And, you know, so you can go in there and spend all day. And that's what we were looking for. We weren't interested in finding anything new because it might only be 700 feet long. You know, we want to go somewhere where we know where we're going, where we can go, have an objective, meet it, and then come back out and pick out on Mexican food. Like that was our whole thing.
Have your tastes changed a bit with the podcast? Have you evolved in your thinking on what you want to pursue?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, the more perspectives that I hear, the more I think, okay, well, maybe I'll shift my aim to something more like that. Or maybe in the future, if I have time, one of the best moments that I had as far as like my current conundrum with caving was talking to Derek Bristol. And I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast or if it was off the record, but he said, you know, I didn't go caving for 15 years. And while his kids grew up, and I'm in that phase where I'm like not caving as much at all, like maybe two or three times a year because my kids are still small. And he went away from it. He did it a lot back in the day and then went away from it and then came back in a huge, huge way. I mean, it's Derek. So that was really encouraging to me. And, you know, I'm glad that I'm doing the podcast because I just wonder if I weren't doing it, would caving be something that could potentially go away forever were I not still involved in this way. So in that way, I'm really, really thankful to be doing the podcast because I could see myself, and this happens with a lot of people with a lot of different things, and it certainly happened with me, where you'll be into something for a while and then it just goes away. Now I'm beholden to it. The first of the month is the boss. You know, I got to put out a new episode, so I got to stay involved.
Have you heard the term BNC? Have you heard the term BNC?
No,
You've not heard this.
Maybe.
So this is, I'll give you an education now. It's a big joke that Derek and I have between each other. Have you been to an NSS convention?
No, I haven't even been to one.
Right. And you should go. They're quite a lot of fun.
I was going to go this year, and then whatever happened. But I would like to go to South Dakota next year.
Oh, it's going to be fabulous. I encourage you to go. I'll take you caving.
okay.
So BNC is an acronym for Big Name Caver. And you hear this a lot at convention and people, and it's kind of a joke. You know, the BNC, you know, is Bill Stone. And, you know, you've already interviewed Bill and you got some of that. And the joke is like, you know, who is BNC number one and BNC number two? And that might seem like very kind of like self-serving and elitist and stuff, but it's really just a joke. But BNC is a term that's used to describe big name cavers, like you like your Bill Stones, your Bill Steels, and people like that.
Yeah.
And you've become that BNC now.
No.
You have. No. And that's the thing is, I find it very fascinating that you're very modest in the way that you approach things, because you have this fabulous career now in radio and you've done this podcast that's been transformative. You talk about caving as like, I'm not much of a caver and all this kind of stuff. And you've been caving for 10 years and you've obviously done a lot. And so I don't know if you've experienced that tipping point. It must be weird. People must hear your voice and go, wait, what? You know, and recognize you. Have you had anything like that where it's become about more about you?
I had a little bit of that at Spelio Fest. I ran into some people who, all right, you're the podcast guy, which was kind of cool to be the podcast guy, I guess. And I'm always surprised at who's heard it. You know, when I found out that Bill Steele had heard it and was like, hey, you got to have me on, which is super nice because it's like, okay, when I don't have to chase them down, it's great. And so that was cool. But yeah, I had a little bit of that at At Spelio Fest. I've had a little bit of it this weekend too, which is really nice because this is my event. You know, this is Indiana Cave Capers is the one that I've always been to and gone to. You know, I went to one Tagfall Cave In. I went to one Spelio Fest this past one. Other than that, it's just been nothing but Indiana Cave Capers. So this is my backyard jam.
It's kind of interesting because caving is a really small pond, right? And
yeah.
So I've always said that, you know, it's very easy to become a big fish in a small pond. And it's very flattering to be recognized for what you've accomplished, but none of us that do it as much as we do it for that recognition. We do it because we're passionate about what we do. Mm. But I do find it interesting that some people who become slightly big fish in that pond will often make a big fuss that they are that person and kind of flaunt that. And I think it's very it's nice that you're really kind of modest about your accomplishments. And I think it's good because the way that you interview people is coming from a position where probably a lot of your listeners are at, where they're like, you know, I'm just kind of starting out or I haven't done a lot. And I would really love to sit down and have a conversation with Bill Stone or Bill Steele.
Yeah.
So do you think that has fed into the popularity of what you've done?
I'm glad you asked that because I have thought about that. And I have thought that maybe that is the case. The fact that I am at the level that I'm at and don't know everything and will sometimes ask, okay, well, what does that mean? You know, like when Adam Weaver brought up Elruds and I had no idea what he was talking about. You know what I mean? And I'm glad that he clarified that because not only did I get it, but they got it too, if that's the level that they're at. So in that, I've also thought, well, maybe I don't want to go. Maybe I'm at an advantage that I'm not doing what all these other project cavers are doing because I'm being educated along with the audience. And so I'm really, yeah, I have thought about that. And I think that's a good place to be for a host, to be on that ground level with the audience. I just need to be better about asking for clarification sometimes because sometimes I just act like I know what people are talking about and then we just go past it without me understanding what the is going on.
and the audience. So yeah. Given that you brought up hosting, can you tell me a little bit about your history in radio? We talked a little bit about it last night. And was this something that, like, you know, when kids decide they're going to be firemen and you decided you're going to be a radio host?
It just kind of kept happening is what it was. My dad's best friend in high school ended up selling ads for a radio station, local radio station, the one closest to my house. And then when I became a sophomore in high school, I was able to take a day off school and job shadow. And I thought, radio station would be pretty cool. So think Randy could hook that up. And he did. I came by and they were like, we're looking for help on, you know, weeknights and for like county fairs and stuff. This is rural Indiana. So the county fair is the only thing that ever happens throughout the year, that or maybe a few church festivals. And so like, we need somebody to go out to the county fair and we'll put you up under the tractor tent and you could broadcast live over the phone to the radio station and tell everybody what's going on at the fair. So I did that. And then they had me run baseball games, like, from the radio station and just did whatever they needed me to do. And I was like, well, this is kind of cool.
How old were you when you were doing this?
15 is when I started.
Wow.
So I've been doing it for 22 years. 23 years now. God. And so that's how that got going. And I just never stopped doing it. And I got better at it and I thought it was cool. And then I developed this obsession with microphones and I wanted to keep working with microphones. So I'm like, well, I got to get good at using a microphone in order to stay around microphones. It's the dumbest thing in the world, but it's really fun for me. And then did some part-time stuff in Indianapolis, which made me feel like a badass because I was on the radio in Indianapolis, as a 20-year-old, and then, you know, it just escalated. And then I put in 8.5 years full-time at a corporate radio station in Indianapolis, got sick of that, decided to do nothing but voiceover for a while. 6 months to the day after I left, I was hired at the public radio station because that was how long it took for my non-compete to wear out. Went and worked at the public radio station, which is NPR affiliate, and that's where I found the audience. Because when I left corporate radio, I thought that was it. I was like, nah, I'm done. This was fine, but it was a lot of work, and radio's dying. It's never going to. It's a cockroach. It'll be around forever. But That was my thinking at the time. And then I went to the public radio and people actually started to like appreciate my, I don't know, sonic aesthetic or whatever it was. And then they were like, do you want a talk show? And I had been doing the Caving podcast to try to get better as an interviewer. And that's how that happened. And now I've got a super chill job hosting rock radio in the morning, you know? So that's the evolution there, I guess. Yes,
the people I was caving with today said they listened to you in the morning and they said you're very good at it. I have, what is the station again so people can kind of tune in?
WTTS out of Indianapolis. It is, we don't really talk about format, but the format is AAA Adult Album Alternative or Adult Alternative Americana. So you'll hear like Tom Petty back to back with the Black Keys, something like that. So it's just a laid back, chill music lover station.
So can you go back a little bit to, you said you started the podcast to get better at interviewing people to get the NPR job?
Or? No, I knew that doing something significant in radio would involve interviewing people, because I have no interest in expressing my political opinion or anything like that. Too many people are talking about what they believe politically and it's too divisive, and we've seen where it got us. And so there was a time when I wanted to do that. Now I don't think anyone should be doing it because it's not helpful. But I knew that if I wanted to do something significant in radio, I would have to get good at interviewing. And so I wanted to develop a style, but you can't do that without doing it. And so for me, the Caving podcast was the best way to do that, because these are people who have a shared interest with me. And if I want to pull a certain story out of them, what I need to do is learn what story they want to tell and how they want to tell it or what they want to talk about. One of my favorite questions to ask, and I always edit it out, is what do you want to talk about? Or what else do you want to talk about? Or is there anything else? Or whatever it is, how do you want to tell your story? To find that, to search for that, and then to hit on it in just the right way, that's a feeling that I would equate to caving. That's an adventure too. you know?
It sounds a lot like science, right?
Is it about?
Yeah, because, you know, you see something weird and you're like, what is that? And until you figure out what question to ask, which is what experiment do you do, you're like, you're flapping around. You have no idea what's going on.
That's
and then,
a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. You have a tipping point and then you're like, oh yeah, that's the core of it. That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah. Okay. I like that then, because one thing I love about what you do is there's so much of that. You can talk to some, I mean, you'll go surveying, you'll find new cave, and that's part of what you are too, but you ask other questions. There are some people who, for them, it's really maybe the only thing they want to do or the only thing they know how to do or care to know how to do is find new cave, and that's great. But there's other things, there's other facets of it for you. And not to turn the tables, because you've turned the tables on me. I don't mean to turn the tables on you, but those two curiosities, they work in tandem sometimes, right? They're working at the same time for you often, right?
They are, but I don't think there's any structural difference to turn the table back on you with what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
Because I had a training in a science and I loved caves. And at some point I was like, well, I can do this one thing with the training I have. And that's pretty much what you've done, right? I mean, you've captured something that was missing, which is people's stories. And when you talk about an oral history, you know, especially with like Dick Blentz, you know, capturing that was, I mean, it was a beautiful interview. And it really, like, I'd seen Dick at convention for years and he was a lovely guy and I would talk, you know, go up and talk to him. But I had no idea of that whole backstory. And to me, it just completely enriched the memory I had of that person and how valuable he had been without really recognizing that. So I think, you know, when you talk about, you know, what you have bought as far as my science, I really don't think that there's any difference in weight between what you're doing as far as capturing those oral histories and what I'm doing and being like, you know, oh, this microbe does X in a cave.
Yeah.
Society values it differently. But I think when you think about caving in the US and where we're going with caving in the US and the community we're building, that's also being done by changing our communication styles, which are, you know, the videos on YouTube, the podcast, you know, it's, and I think I want to get back to that idea of communication and kind of ask you, you know, your expertise. And I asked this, I when I did the IMAX movie, I had 6 weeks of communication training, and I thought it was the biggest I've ever experienced in my life.
Because I wondered about this.
They were like, you know, basically lie. And I'm like, no, I refuse to lie. I won't even bring up a subject, right? So there was a couple of things that happened during film with the IMAX that were for convenience while we were filming. And they were like, well, if somebody asks you about X, how are you going to respond? And I'd tell them how they respond. And they were like, no, we'd like you to do it this way. And it was like, no. Mm. So there's like professional communications where you're trying to sell a product, which I think is what I was being taught with the IMAX. But I think communicating, especially as cavers, it's really, really hard to get the general public to understand. And this is getting back a bit to your, you know, your chasing the dragon thing, is understand why we have a passion and why we have a love for what we do and how to communicate it. So how do you communicate that with all the experience you have? What are the best communicators of caving? Who are those great interviews, and how do people learn to do that when they're asked by relatives or workmates, or, you know, a journalist asks them, is like, how to communicate, how to get this across?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about the IMAX situation, because it's like sometimes producers will go in, and especially when you're dealing with something like IMAX, where the camera is enormous and you can only take it in certain places, you, as a producer of something like that, you kind of have to be selective about what story you can tell. You know what I mean? Because you can only tell certain stories. You can't bring an IMAX camera into a tight space. You know what I mean? So you guys did what you did. What I am trying to illustrate, or help people illustrate, and I do this not just through the interview, but also the edit afterward, is to most concisely illustrate their experience and their passion for it. But they have to show up with the enthusiasm in their voice for it. And sometimes it takes a while to get there with certain people. And with some people, it's there right away. And you can hear the tone. And what I'm always trying to get from somebody is that, and which is why for so long I focused so much on the high adventure, you know, things like that. And I still want to focus on that. But I've gotten some feedback recently that said, you know, I like it when you do that, but like they listen to yours and you're talking about science. And you're also talking about high adventure, and you're also talking about survey and all these other things. So we kind of got a little bit of everything from you. But then there was George Venny, who talked about nothing but, you know, his organizations the whole time. And it was great because it illustrated that whole side of it. Because he's like, yeah, I mean, we could talk about my personal caving history, but I'm kind of more interested in talking about this. So like, I'm here to talk about whatever you want to talk about where that's concerned. But I guess to answer your question is what I'm always going for is I want to create an environment where you're comfortable sharing your enthusiasm, where you're comfortable nerding out. You know what I mean? Because that's what people will feel. They'll feel your enthusiasm for it if they can hear it in your voice. Don't be shy about it. So that's why when I was going around talking to people last night, a few of them were like, let me get a couple more beers in me first. And I was like, fine. You go right ahead. Whatever makes you comfortable. Because when you're most comfortable, it's like when you're around a campfire, you get the best stuff. So
you think people need to kind of share their story or their passion?
Their passion. But for so many people, that is the story. Not for so many people, for some people. There are some people who are just great storytellers. And then that's how they can share the passion. And I love a good story, but I also just like passion. And a good story isn't told without passion. So it's not necessarily the story, but if you get both, it's bonus.
So you talked a little bit about getting feedback from people, and we've talked about like positive feedback and the positive aspects of it. I know that Derek has had some pretty bad negative feedback. Have you had any negative feedback, and what was the response?
I'm surprised how little negative feedback I've gotten, honestly. Because when I first started it, I thought, I'll do this for a little while until a bunch of old-timers complain. Because I was expecting that. because you know the first rule of caving, first and second rule is not talk about caving, which I've always had a problem with and which I've been a little more outspoken about now that I've been doing this long enough, because we are getting to a point where membership is falling. Not enough young people are picking it up. And I think the best way to combat that is to throw away rule one and two. Start talking about it. Get it out there. We need to be as secretive as we need to be. I believe in that, some of that. But, you know, why are we not talking about X and Y out in public? We certainly can. Are we afraid of people picking it up because then there'll be a ton of cavers? No, because not everybody can do this. Not everybody can crawl into a tight space. Some people are afraid of water. Some people are not going to do this. But the ones that are, we need them. You know, it's kind of where I'm at with it.
I think there is a big disconnect in that we are passionate about it in a certain way, and we think everyone is equally passionate about it. When I did the IMAX movie, there was huge blowback. And the reason I joined
within them, caving?
Within caving. And the reason I was on the NSS Board of Governors for 6 years, and the reason I ran, was elected, is there were elements in the NSS that wanted the IMAX movie banned. And they were going to try
it was harmless.
And they were going to try and have it banned, and they were going to try and have protests outside of the IMAX theaters. And, you know, nothing would sell better than controversy, right? I mean, yeah. The best way to get a record to number one is to label it explicit. But, you know, and people said that, I mean, people came up to me and told me to my face I was going to destroy caving because it would encourage people to go caving. And it's like, good, right? I mean, it's like, you know, everybody wants to be secretive until there's a quarry going in that will destroy their favorite cave. And then they want to blast everything out to the media and get people excited. And it's like, you need to be doing that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So the locals know about it. The locals appreciate it. And then you have a block of people that can push back. So we're not talking about me. We're talking about your opinions. But but I do believe things need to change. And I think the podcast is really important in bringing about that change. And, you know, you're a very modest person. And you know, this is the thing that cracks me up, is because how smart and intelligent and hardworking you are. And yet you're very modest. And as you said, it's a benefit to the podcast because it brings people along for the ride. But at the same time, you know, at some point there's going to be a tipping point. You're going to be like, I've changed things, and I've changed things for the better. And yeah, you can shake your head and look away and blush, but you know, it's
I'm from the Midwest, Hazel. I can't help it.
Yeah. But you know, you'll look back on this, and these are battles that I've fought, you know, even with the science, these are battles I fought, and it's a different landscape right now. I could go into a cave and fart and people think I've done a miraculous thing in the cave, you know? So, I think it's a changing landscape, and it does take pioneers to be willing to take that risk and do it. So I want to back up a little bit, and can you kind of walk me through a podcast from emailing someone to the interview to the processing and editing? I mean, what kind of, like, I just assume it must take months based on when you interviewed me and when the interview came out. What does that process look like?
Oh, it's just so it's changed a little bit, but it's from the beginning, it's been about like this. So I'll reach out, I'll contact somebody, or someone will contact me. It's awesome when someone just reaches out to me and says, hey, I want to be interviewed. And if I've heard of them, it's great. But if not, I'm like, well, who are you? You know, there have been a few times where, you know, someone's reached out and we'll talk for a little bit, and then I'll decide, maybe not now. We'll talk, but maybe I'll shelve it for a little bit. But most of the time, I'll just get a hold of somebody, get them on the schedule. You know, do you have an hour at this time window? Then we'll book a Zoom. And we'll talk for an hour, hour and a half, and then I'll probably wait until 3 days before I'm supposed to post it, and then I'll edit, which usually takes about, God, it takes sometimes, I mean, if it's a one-hour episode, it'll take at least 2 hours to edit, and that's fast, like I'm moving fast, but I'll go in and I'll snip out long pauses, I'll snip out sections that were, you know, didn't really go anywhere, I'll snip out this and that. And I'll make it more concise. If someone's not a great communicator, I'll make them a great communicator in the edit, because I know what it takes for a person to sound like that. And which is why a lot of people, and a lot of people hesitate to agree to do it, because they don't think they're a great communicator. You don't understand. I will make you sound like you do this all the time. You know what I mean? I didn't have to do much for you because you're constantly in front of students and other giving other presentations. You know how to communicate. But for some other people, it's been a long edit, but I will make it good for the listener because your story deserves to be told the way it needs to be told for people to get it. So I'll do the edit. I'll write an outline for the intro. I used to script out the intro completely and I would read every word verbatim, but now I just kind of outline it and then I'll edit that, put it at the top, put the cave waterfall sound effect in at the top and the bottom, and then off to the races. That's how it goes. But I would say in a given month, the amount of time that I have to spend on it is, so 90 minutes for the actual interview, at least two hours for the edit, another hour for intro and edit and everything else, write the description, finalize it. So you're looking at, 6 to 8 hours a month. That's a decent chunk of change for something I'm not getting paid for. So
tell me about it.
I have a sponsor, but he pays me in lights. So,
hey, that's
good. That's good. I'm okay with it.
And those are nice lights.
Yeah.
Has it ever felt like a chore?
Yes. Yeah. But I would say it felt like a chore just before. It would never feel like a chore again. In other words, it felt like a chore up until the point where people started reaching out and saying, hey, this is really cool. So I would say that happened about a year and a half in. It was really cool to have Scott McRae reach out early on and say, hey, I'll sponsor you. What? Really? The Swago guy? Okay. So that was a nice shot in the arm. But after a while, maybe another year or so after that, it was just like, I don't know, do I want to keep doing this? And at about that point, It was serendipitous because then I started hearing from people like, this is really cool. Hey, have you talked to this person? I don't know who you are. You're from where? And so that was when I knew I had hit on something and had found the audience. So now it's just something that I want to do because it's so good for the caving community, or it seems like it has been. So yeah, I would say that.
Is there a target segment that you don't think you've hit? I mean, it seems to me like you do a good balance of these big name cavers, international folks, and then local Indiana cavers.
I haven't talked to enough tag people.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of people that I haven't talked to. I would like to talk to everybody, but tag is such a marvelous place, and I've talked to 3-4 tag cavers, tag well-knowns, So I think that is, as far as where some of the best caving in the States is, it's underrepresented on the podcast, to be sure. And women, too, for that matter. I mean, you look at the first two years, I was one woman, and I didn't like that, but it was just the guests I could get. Now, I'm last year and the year before, at least, were 50-50 represented. I don't know if this year will be. I hope it will be. Can we count this? So I'm trying to make up for lost time on women cavers because it's so important. And is this awkward? Can we talk about this? There's not a lot of minority cavers. I don't see a lot of Asian cavers. I don't see almost any black cavers. I want to find those people and hear their story and show people why that difference matters. Because what was the whole blowback on the NSS Facebook page not that long ago about an outreach, like a diversity and outreach thing, and people were shitting all over it? I'm like, why? We want other communities to know about this because those kinds of communities sometimes can be really insular. And if you get one person interested, then they can share their influence with their insular community. And then we can, make things look a little more like the rest of the world in this caving community.
I think it's so. I've served on a lot of diversity committees and done a lot of diversity work. And, I think there's a lot of cultural issues, and so, it's about privilege and access and having the disposable income to pursue a hobby like this where you're not working, three jobs, but. There's also a cultural aspect where, some groups, when I was in China, the locals didn't want to go caving. And they didn't want to go caving because they had one pair of shoes and they did not want to get their shoes dirty. And it's like, well, then you buy them a new pair of shoes. And then you start getting into the real issue is poverty. And you know, it kind of escalates. So I'm always very concerned about tokenism and diversity. I do think that diversity is an issue that we have, but it's a very large and broad issue. The one thing I would say is that caving, in my experience, has been very open to alternate lifestyles.
Yeah.
And I want to speak to the LGBTQ community. When I started caving in America in 93, like, no one gave a toss what your sexual orientation was, whether you were, you know, transgender. No one cared. If you were
a caver, and that
you
was
were
all
a caver, and you know, we're kind of a counterculture group, and no one cared. Like, you know, I used to cave a lot with Donald Davis in Colorado, and the big joke was the most normal thing about Donald was that he was gay. No one cared, you know. And I think it's really important. I think that we are a very open and welcoming community, and you know, especially like, you know, we, you know, LGBTQ people were, you know, respected and awarded and serving in office and receiving our major awards, you know, 30 years ago. And it wasn't about, you know, their background or you know, their religion or sexual orientation. It was like, are you a caver?
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of value in that. But I do appreciate the efforts you've gone to. I know you and I had a discussion early on about, you know, gender diversity. And I really do appreciate it. And for me as a female caver, those voices really need to be heard, because it's that 14-year-old girl in her bedroom listening to the podcast that decides that she heard something, you know, like you saying with Derek saying, you know, it's okay to have a second career in you know, a second act in caving, mm-hmm. is that she can hear a voice that she can resonate with and choose to do that. So, you know, there's many ways it's valuable, and I think the podcast is really done a lot with that. And it's a thorny issue, and it's one that needs to be addressed, and there's no easy solution, and we need to be careful about seeking those easy solutions. But yeah, I can hook you up with some okay. Asian cavers. There's plenty of fantastic ones.
Let's do it.
So I want to, we've probably been doing this for what, an hour now?
Almost, well, 48 minutes.
48 minutes. So
not too bad.
So I want to talk about caves now.
Okay.
So
let's do it.
The two caves that I always hear you say, and I think you probably say these in every podcast. Do you know what those two are?
Buckner and Lechuguilla?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
all right, let's
so
go.
Talk to me about the fascination with Buckner, because you obviously love that cave.
It's just, it's got a little bit of everything. The classic trip is the circle route, and you can, and it has everything except for rope work. You know what I mean? It's a great introduction to caving, because it shows you all of the horizontal stuff. You're doing tight breakdown crawls. You're doing a little bit of climbing. You're in the water for a little bit of it. You're in open trunk passage. You can, there's a couple squeezes. There's a fall in, you know, where you jump down, and you got to kind of psych yourself up for that as a first timer doing that. And so if you can get through the Buckner circle route and you liked it, like you really liked it, well then by God, you're a caver. You know what I mean? But so many people do that and they're like, okay, that was enough. And then that's it. Well, I think it's a good, what did people say? It's a good nerd filter. You do the Buckner Circle route and you like it, well, then you can do other stuff. And there's other stuff to do there, too. You could spend an entire day in Buckner. Obviously, it's a 3.5-mile cave. You wouldn't see all of it. And there are some places you wouldn't want to see. But that's why I like that one. And it's only an hour away from my house. So, well, an hour and a half. And it's got this history, you know, this really rich history of being bought, and then everybody knowing about it, and then that cave, and then all the other caves around it being explored, and then that cave being trashed and disrespected, and then that cave rising from the ashes with the cleanup. And, you know, there's still no shortage of trash and graffiti in Buckner, but we've cleaned a lot of that out, but the history is still there. And so it's like, here is, yeah, it's a sacrificial cave. Hundreds of thousands of people have been in this cave, but we have done our best to bring it back into a place where we can enjoy it again while also respecting the sordid history. I loved talking to Sam Freshour about Buckner when I interviewed him, and I went caving with him today, which was great. I was with a who's who of Indiana cavers today. It was awesome. It was Dan Chase and Sam Freshour, Dan, brother of Dale Chase, who passed away, Patty Cummings, and Dave and Susie Strickland. I mean, it was just, I couldn't believe these people were on my trip, that I couldn't find the cave. We went to a different cave, whatever. We went caving. It's fine. But they were my group, and it was so cool. And so that's one of the reasons I like Buckner. And, I mean, why wouldn't anyone like Lechuguilla? You know what I mean? That's why I talk about that one, because it's just amazing. It keeps on going. There's stuff you'll see in there that you won't see anywhere else. There's incredible biodiversity there that you also won't find anywhere else. I mean, it's just a wonderland.
It's interesting. It's very hot. Are you familiar with the heat?
Yes. What is it? 67 and total humidity?
At the entrance, it's closer to 69, 70 deeper in, 71 deeper in the cave.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
And
yeah.
You gotta work out to be able to do that. You need to be like top shape, because you're doing it with a, you know, like I've carried a 45-pound pack through there. You know, we've talked about your rope experience, so talk to me, because, you know, you and I had a very short discussion last night, and I'm like, well, you know, I've got some day trip stuff coming up, you know, tell me about your vertical experience. And you're like, no, I'm pretty good on vertical.
I can do vertical. Yeah, I mean, I've been down to Tag a few times. I did Conley Hole, which is about 160 feet. That's Boulder Falls. I've done Flowing Stone, which is about 220. There are a few other tag, I wouldn't call them classics, but other tag caves that I've done where it's a good drop. And then in Indiana, we have Gory Hole, which I've done two or three times. It's 140 feet. That's our deepest. A couple other 100 footers. And I love it. And I got a rope in my backyard that I'll climb sometimes, you know? So yeah, I feel like I could handle that part of it.
When was the first time you went into a cave using a rope? Not just necessarily the entrance, but used a rope in a cave?
Ooh. Well, it was probably just my first pit. Green Eye 1 in Indiana. There are two Green Eye pits. There's one on private property. I think the other one's on private property too, but it's across the road. And I think Green Eye 2 is the only one that's open now. Green Eye 1's now closed to an unfriendly landowner, which is fine. It's whatever. But it's a 100 footer, 96, something like that. And it was just down and back up. And we did it four times that day because I was like, wow, it's my first time. That was the first. Probably the one I've done the most is Freeman Pit, which is a very similar. It's just 195 feet down, back up. Then there's Gory Hole, which is the deep one in Indiana. But yeah, the first one was Green Eye, and I knew I was going to like it because I had done our vertical thing that we do in the winter every year. Our grotto sponsors a vertical day where we teach vertical. And I'd done that, and I knew I liked it. And I knew I liked caving, and I knew that if I needed to travel on that axis, I would need to do that. If I were to choose which one I would do all the time, whether it's vertical or horizontal, I would choose horizontal, but I like a good vertical day. So I guess that's where I'm at on the vertical.
And was that like a natural evolution for people in your grotto to be like kind of some level of horizontal and then take this vertical training in preparation?
Yeah, you almost never see it go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You kind of have to do it in that order, right? I mean, you can do it in the other order, and it's cool if you do, and if that's been your story, then great. I mean, that's unique, but you kind of, it's just the way it goes, usually.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you the question that you like to ask, which is, what have I missed?
Oh, what have you missed?
Mm.
I think what I'm always trying to get from people is that is the best sense of that feeling. It's like talking about love. You can't ever put the right words in the right order at the right rhythm to get it right, to illustrate it fully. So the same thing, I don't mean to equate love with caving, but you as well as anybody knows that that's kind of what I'm talking about. You can never fully capture any emotion or feeling that you can get from something and illustrate it, but you can come close. And what I'm always trying to get is that passion. And so I've tried to capture that through the way people talk about caving. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But all I can do is come close. And I'm going to keep trying. And I'm going to keep coming close. And I can't wait to share other people's stories. Other Dick Blenses who may not have that much more time left, but whose stories need to be told to a broader audience than just, you know, half a dozen people around a campfire. once at convention. You know what I mean? Not everybody's going to remember that. There's no record of that except for what people say. And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes a legend is greater than a recorded history. But I think that the latter is as important.
Okay. Another question you'd like to ask.
What
should I carry in my pack?
I'm not going to tell you what to carry in your pack.
Well, you and I probably have very different choices that we make when we put our pack together because we cave in very different environments. So yeah. I have noticed that Indiana tends toward mud.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different environment. When we went caving today, there were, I think, 7 Swagos in the pile.
Oh, yeah.
And by the end of the trip, it was impossible to tell which ball of mud was which Swago. You just had to grab one and trust based on the weight.
If you're caving in Binkley, if you're caving under the sinkhole plains in Indiana, you're bringing a Swago. If you're doing the long trip in Sullivan, you're bringing a Swago. You know, if you're doing a Buckner Circle route trip, you don't need to bring a Swago. You can just bring a Gonzo Guano or an on-rope one. You know, you're just going to get muddy. But yeah, there's no shortage of Swago need in Indiana for sure. But what's in my pack, it depends. If I'm leading, I've got a lot more than if I'm not. But if I'm not, all I've got is maybe 2 Nalgenes, one with water and one with Mirandos. You know, just whatever. Extra batteries, you know, some candy bar, whatever. But if I'm leading, I've also got this, like, dry box with a little first aid kit and other stuff in there. That's all I got because all I do is day trips. So I'm not bringing all the food that I see you laying out all nice and neat and Tetrising into your pack, which is very impressive to me. I wouldn't know where to begin where that's concerned, but you've got a lot more experience on me. So,
well, we all have to learn somewhere, right?
Exactly. And you can only learn by doing it.
Yeah. Well, actually, going into Leche Guía is where I got initially most of my camping experience, and that's expanded from there. But we talk to each other and we share gear lists, and everybody has a gear list and everybody has like a preference. And I think when I lead an expedition into Leche Guía, I've got like 7 gear lists, mine. And then, you know, everybody else who's ever put one together to share, I've captured that. And then when we have a newbie, I blast all 7 at them and I say, you pick, you know, you decide this is your trip.
Mm-hmm.
And gear lists are critical because you're down there for 8 days and you get down there on day 1 and you realize you forgot something critical.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to live without it. And if you can't live without it, it means you take a team out of the survey to go to the entrance, travel all the way back to the huts, mm-hmm. and then come back in the cave. So mm-hmm. you better have a list that you can check off.
Well, it's also like going into orbit, though, in that every extra ounce has a cost. In this case, it's not money, it's energy,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And there's the trade-offs. Like, I bring a chair. I have, like, a little ultralight folding chair and fairy lights. And the fairy lights started because my husband has, like, seasonal defective disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets super grumpy about, like, day 4. And so I bought these lights for him. And I must admit, I did steal the idea from someone else. But it's great because you don't have to wear your helmet at camp. Or a strap around your head with a tika, and you've had something on your head all day because you've been in the cave, and you mm-hmm. can get back to camp and you can potter about without something on your head. So I bring fairy lights and I bring a folding chair. You know, I mean, the climbers bring a lot of gear. You know, we're splitting gear from the climbers, but, you know, some of the packs, you know, James Hunter's packs, I've picked his pack up and it's weighed like 55 pounds and it's all climbing gear, right? And then there's a
rope. But if you can carry it, then why not? Just bring
it. Yeah, and he's strong enough to carry it. I would never let a newbie, but, you know, actually, James brings fairy lights and chairs, but some people disdain that. You know, some people even disdain a pillow, and I'm sleeping underground for 8 days. I'm bringing a pillow. So we do talk and we do share. And I think, you know, that's really important for new people. I think that there's a reluctance. You don't want to seem ill-informed or novice. But I think it's really important to ask on those things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one more question I want to ask you, and then we'll finish up with this one.
Yeah, because we got to go eat.
Eat
dinner.
You haven't caved internationally. Where would that be?
Oh,
and
man.
Why?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, a tourist trip in some of the deep pits in Mexico sounds good, but I don't know if I'd stand at the lip of Golondrinas and have the guts to do it right now. As a father now, Like before I was a father, I think I would in a second. But now I'm like 1,200 feet, huh? Free drop. I'd have an awful long time to think about my kids not having a dad on the way down if something happened. So that has changed a little bit. But since talking to some of the UK cavers, there's some cool stuff over there. I'd love to go see Ogafun and Thee, you know?
You said that correctly.
I did. How about that? I learned how to, thanks to the podcast. And, you know, some of those classics over there, because they seem a lot like what we've got in Indiana. But then I might go there and discover that they're not and that they have their own magic to them, which I think is probably what I'll find.
OFD is a magical cave.
Yeah.
I would... And it's, I think it used to be the deepest, if not, it's still the deepest in the UK. It is a magical cave. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to see that. So I guess that's the short answer.
Well, we can hook you up. UK okay. is easy. I can hook you up. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think we should go get some food.
Let's go get some barbecue.
Are you going to use this or are you just going to?
I'm going to use this.
On the shelf?
Are you going to I'm going to use this. It's another hour with Hazel Barton.
So there you have it. Me and Hazel Barton shooting the breeze at Indiana Cave Capers. If you enjoyed that, subscribe to this podcast. I'd love to know who you would like to hear on the podcast in 2022. And also, if you want to borrow my El Spelio Lunatic Light, you can do both of those things the same way by sending me an email, alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. Also, thanks to our sponsors, past and present, of course, El Spelio, as I mentioned. elspelio.com. I've got a link in the description of this podcast to elspelio.com. And remember to use the promo code podcast if you're going to buy one and save $20. Also, thanks to Swago. You do a lot of wet caving. Swago, you got to have one of those. Swagogear.com. Or if your grotto is going to make some t-shirts in 2022, Charlie at Organic Robot Designs would love to help you out. He's got a brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana. Go to organicrobotdesigns.com. Let's see what else. I don't know who I'm having next month. Don't know. Don't have an interview in the can. I'll figure something out, though. I always do. I hope you'll be here for it. In the meantime, thanks for listening and kill nothing but time.